You have the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra. Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time the Bhagwan was dwelling on massive vultures mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagwan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra: any son of the lineage of daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the perfection of wisdom should look upon this light correctly and repeatedly, beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty, emptiness as form, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unseized, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no mutual tone, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, no phenomenon. There is no air element and so on up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance and so on up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear, having completely they reach the end point of nirvana, all the Buddhas who dwell in the three kinds manifestly. Perfect, complete enlightenment, reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is this: Tata Om Gate Gate Para Gate Parasam Gate Bodhi Soha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagwan arose from that concentration and commented in Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage. It is like that, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagwan take the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, the Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. Kala jibe nejo tamba ning ushe dhidru mawet Rupa bola maye pushin sin nizun kandu sola cha se lo Aukka samaraj Aukka samaraja shadara samaraya phe Teyatha gade gade paragati parasana bhujita pao kuja sunkai dhembe tukki chher doba juji mewa juji shiva juji dhage bhaji mehde me chori nge bhaji mje shimde kuru giri tonta kya juji vadaan mehde nebe kintan tre vadaan thumbar gyunji phusun sokyo be tashi te kyan tindra dele sho Pöke chushin medho dhamma rera lingshin yinde gin Sangye shindu mikde pöwa Rokun namda shingla jöpara Pöjin bunre de thaye rodi pinde kunde Ketan yundu nedan pöwe Sabge chöki charva abdu Okay, now welcome back to this session. Listen to the discourse with the right motive and the right intention as it comes from the words of lineage masters. Yesterday, we finished up to the stanza number, stanza number 12, and I forgot the Gishin Antargis commentary. Maybe we need to refer to that some in certain occasion. It's okay. He went to bring it. Okay. Now we are at the paragraph of stanza number 13, and stanza number 13 covers the portion. Which explains to avoid breaking the heart of the master. It's very important to do this as long as someone have maintained or someone have built up, created a relationship with a spiritual master. So it reads like, never disturb your guru's mind. Should you be foolish and happen to do this, you will surely boil in hell. So it says, never disturb Guru's mind. So actually it means don't break the heart of the master. In a very common language, you know. If you say disturb your Guru's mind, this is not that common expression. So the common expression is don't break the heart of the master. It's very important. And as it is explained here, if a disciple happened to break the heart of the master, then as a result of it, they will surely get boiled or maybe burned in the hell as a result of that. And it is also compiled from the sutras, those were taught by the Buddha. Also from the certain part of the Tantra, the name of that Tantra is Dasang Thile, that is in Tibetan. It is compiled from that Tantric treatise. And even the certain treatise on the Sutra also explains the same thing. So it's like that. So most of these stanzas, most of these stanzas on Guru devotion are a compilation of the meanings, those already exist in major treatises on the Sutra and Tantra. So it's not a kind of, invention and innovation and creation of the Arishura or the that is we also say Ashwaghosha. And these kind of stanzas are compiled with a great Santa's stanzas are compiled with a great purpose. This is Arishura may have found that many disciples, after accepting someone as master and after building up a kind of master and disciple relationship, they don't maintain the sound and healthy maintenance of the relationship in between the master and disciple. So in order to stop that kind of misconduct and misunderstood notion, kind of misconduct driven by misunderstood notion, Arishura may have compiled and composed this. So it's it's very important to understand in that manner. And then the next paragraph explains a certain unseen harm or retribution that one can get if they don't respect the master properly, or they despise the master and do the practice improperly or in a kind of negative way. So the stanza reads, this is number 14, whatever fearful hells have been taught, such as Avicii, the hell of uninterrupted pain, it is clearly explained that those who disparage their guru will have to remain there a very long time. So in the sutras and in the tantras, they explain various levels of the hell. Now we are using this word hell many times, and in the modern era, in the modern time, when majority of the people, they believe just in the things that they can see and they can touch and they can feel, not in the things that they can hear. It's a little bit difficult to convince them to believe in the hell and convince them to accept the existence of hell. But as I told you earlier, if we summarize everything that exists in the whole universe, from the tiniest of the atom, maybe it goes further down, like nucleus, and then those like very tiny bit of those things like quarks, and they do have a very distinct kind of reference like P meson and something like those. But anyway, it doesn't matter. From the tiniest particle up to the biggest thing that exists in the world and exists in the universe, if we categorize these things, we can categorize these things into three classifications or three categories, as I explained earlier. Certain things that we can easily perceive. It is an object of perception. It's very easy, easily understood, understandable. There are certain things, those are slightly obscure, that I explained to you earlier. And there are certain things, those are extremely kind of obscure. There are only ways that one can understand those things is through relying upon someone's word. You cannot prove that. Just imagine. Do you believe in the existence of 9 planets or 7 planets and whole kind of solar system and all those things? But we cannot see the solar system. We are presented with some photographs. If I don't trust the authenticity of those photographs, then what can you do? Nothing. If someone show me on those kind of computers that may be connected to the Hubble telescope or something like that, if I say, I can trust that. Who knows if someone is just creating something behind the scene? So those cannot be proved at all, unless you trust it. So it's like that. But this word trust and belief is a very, very tricky word. What you like to believe and what you don't like to trust is your choice and your selection. It cannot be imposed on you. It is a completely individual decision. So normally, majority tend to not to trust words about hell because it's not comfortable. It is not smooth and sweet to the ear. But that is not a right reason. We cannot simply wipe out the existence of something because it is not comfortable and it is not sweet to the sweet to our ear. At the other hand, if we go through the scriptures that the Buddha taught during his lifetime, there are a lot of kind of live examples of Buddha's disciples. In those days, presenting the existence of hell to their disciples. So all those things, we cannot just simply say that all those things are just a bluff. As I told you earlier, Buddha don't need to cheat us. He achieved whatever he have achieved, whatever he ought to achieve, whatever he needed to achieve through his own hardship, hard work. And for that, he even given up his family, his kind of status, his fame, and his power and everything. A person who has given up all those things is going to cheat us or not? Just think carefully. I don't think a person like that will ever do any cheating. So, it's like that. If you believe it or not, if you trust it or not, it's up to you. It's an individual matter. But it is. If we trust it, it will definitely bring good benefits to ourselves. though it may appear like, oh, if I trust in the hell and existence of hell, if I, what is going to happen if I fall down there, it may appear discomfortable at that moment, but that discomfort has this capacity to bring good things to us, bring improvement and change in us. Why do we work hard? At that moment, while we are working very hard, probably it's very rare to find anyone enjoying that, unless it's an extremely lucky person. So why do we work hard? To be more happy. But at the moment when we are working hard, probably we won't be happy, you know. So it's a very common logic that to achieve something comfortable, happy and peaceful and good, we go through some kind of hardship. And from that sense too, it is more advisable and more logic to trust in the words of the Buddha. So it's like that, unless if it is not trusted, it's very difficult to prove the existence of these things. But they really exist, and when it becomes a kind of evident to us, then it could be too late. So it's very important that we should trust from now and work hard to do something to save ourselves. Unless, because instead of waiting until it becomes evident to us, it's like that. So the thing is, and then we go to the, so this is the unseen harm and unseen kind of retribution that may come as a result of disrespecting and breaking the heart of one's masters and so on. Next passage is the summarizing of these points, what are dealt in between these few paragraphs or few stanzas. And it is done by the stanza number 15, which says, therefore exert yourself wholeheartedly never to belittle your tantric master who makes no display of his great wisdom and virtue. Virtue then, okay, so this is a summarization. This, in this stanza, it is summarized that because of these reasons, if not maintained the relationship properly with one's master, and a healthy and sound relationship, then we may get these resultant retributions. So, in order, because of these possibility of getting these uncomfortable and harmful and painful retribution, you should pay respect and maintain a sound and kind of quality relationship with one's master. So that is what is explained here. Now, by this, we have completed this portion of how we should avoid being disrespectful to one's master. So that was one of the major parts. And this stanza 16 onward, now it teaches us how to be more respectful and what are the ways, what are the physical and vocal conduct to be respectful and show respect to one's master. And this portion covers a huge part of the text. This portion is further divided into eight headings or eight parts of it. First one is to offer the offerings. And the second one is to accept one's own master as the Buddha, or try to look at one's master as a Buddha. And third one is to obey his orders and his advices and guidance and do according to those. And the fourth one is how to deal with those belongings of the master and the people surrounding them. That means the near relative or the family members of the master. Then the fifth one is how to maintain a right conduct, physical and vocal, immediately when one is around the master. And the sixth one is what are the kind of special categories or special qualities of doing the physical kind of paying respect and vocal kind of respect and so on. And the seventh one is to be kind of to avoid being proud and like thinking of oneself very high and important in the presence of the master. And the last one is whatever one does, avoid doing it in a complete freedom and independence. Instead, one should consult the master and do under the guidance of the master. So these are the eight portions that covers the whole conduct, how to be respectful to one's spiritual master. So the first one, how to offer, do the offerings to the master, is further divided into four portions, and it is explained in four kind of steps. The first step is making the offerings in order to cleanse or clear away those any kind of disrespect that may have happened. And the second one is to offer all the things that the disciples own. Third one is the reason why the disciples should do that. And the fourth one is the four general pledges or commitments that one should keep when they relate to one's master. So this first portion out of eight portion is explained through in six stanzas, covering from stanza 16 to stanza 21. So stanza 16 to stanza 21 explains us how to offer the offerings and why to offer the offerings and what are the commitments that one should keep related to doing the offerings and so on. So the stanza 16 reads, if from a lack of awareness you have shown disrespect to your guru, reverently present an offering to him and seek his forgiveness, then in the future such harm as plagues will not befall you. Now, this portion in the bracket doesn't exist in the Tibetan version. Tibetan version just covers, to your guru reverently present an offering to him and his seek his forgiveness. Lama lani kujie yun jethun kyu ki jimbacha. Dheni rinso nabano, shirshin jungwa migyuro. Seek his forgiveness doesn't exist here in the Tibetan original. It says, to your guru reverently present an offering. Offering which is acceptable and which is suitable. And if you do it in that way, it will help you to get rid of those harmful retributions, like those accounted in the previous, stanza number, probably in the stanza number 11 and 12. So you can avoid having those retributions. So it's like that. Now here, so sometimes these translations, even sometimes they add up some words, sometimes they cut short some of the words. It's a little bit complicated. And this stanza is compiled from the commentary of Pelchok, one of the great treatises on the Tantra. And in that book or scripture, it explains how making offering is helpful to restore whatever kind of disrespect has been happened and has been caused. And the stanza number 17 here says, it deals with to offer all those belongings, whatever the disciple owns. It reads, it has been taught that for the guru to whom you have pledged your word of honor to visualize as one with your meditational deity, you should willingly sacrifice your wife, children, and even your life, although these are not easy to give away. Is there need to mention your fleeting wealth? So it says, so once again, the bracketed portion doesn't exist in the Tibetan translation, and fleeting wealth is a fleeting, probably is a kind of used in an expression of expressing kind of explaining that the material wealth that we possess is very impermanent. It keeps on moving. Maybe probably I have $1 million today, maybe after one year it could be possible that I don't have that. So the material possession, whatever we own and whatever we kind of earn, is kind of very unstable. So if we own something unstable, of course, it's much easier to give it up compared to those things. Those are listed here. Sacrifice one's wife and children and even the life itself. So if it is necessary to give those things up to one's master, then a disciple must be willing to do that. It is a very important portion of kind of the proper maintaining of the relationship with one's spiritual master. So here it's very important. If someone doesn't have a qualified master, then maybe the master can ask for many things, you know. So it's very important that everyone should have a qualified master. And if it is qualified master, and qualified master have their own code of conduct. So it works in that way. It is not just a one way working. It works in both ways. If it is not a qualified master, then maybe it may have to work in one single way, that they may impose everything on the disciple, and then they may, master may feel like it is his kind of a right to enjoy everything. But if it is a qualified master, then of course they will definitely don't do that. Of course, master also falls into the in the domain of the functioning of karma and its result. Master is not out of that. So it's like that. So the thing is, where we go? Okay, here. Stanza number 17. Now the stanza number 18 explains the logic and the reason. How does it make sense to offer all these things to the one's master? It is explained, such practice of offering can confer even Buddhahood on zealous in his very lifetime, which otherwise might be difficult to attain even in countless millions of eons. Now here, it is an important reason. It says that if we don't come into contact with the master, now here, especially with the tantric master, then if we don't come in contact with the tantric master, if we only have a kind of sutra master, then the master may be capable to teach us the method which may lead us to kind of enlightenment or the Buddhahood after the struggling, after the hard work of eons, a very long time. Now if we come into contact with the spiritual master, especially the Vajra master, in the tantric practices, then they are capable to teach us certain methods which may lead us to enlightenment in a much, much shorter period. If the conditions are met properly, all the conditions, then even in one lifetime, one very short lifetime of the human being. So, master is such a kind of, the Vajra master, the tantric master is such a miraculous thing that we come into contact. Why not? Why not offer all these things to him who is capable to provide us even the Buddhahood in such a miraculous, unimaginably short period? So this is the reason. This is the logic behind it. Then the number 17, number 19 onwards, 19, 20, and 21st, these three stanzas explains us the commitments and the pledges that one should have or one should maintain. And number 19 reads, always keep your word of honor, always make offerings to the enlightened ones, always make offerings also to your guru, for he is the same as all the Buddhas. First commitment and the first pledge is to keep the word of honor, pledges, and always make the offering to the enlightened ones, those are the Buddhas, and always make offering to one's Vajra master, the Tantric master. So he is similar to the Buddha. Similar to the Buddha in one way, but much greater than Buddha in another way. Similar to the Buddha, he is equally kind of valuable to the Buddha, to ourselves, to us. Buddha happened to be in the world 2,500 some odd years ago. And he taught the Dhamma. And he knew how to lead one common ordinary person from ordinary state to the Buddhahood. And our master is equal to him in that way. He also knows. The Vajra master also knows how to lead, how to guide a practitioner from first step up to the final stage. So they are equal in that sense. But Vajra master is much more precious and valuable to us than Buddha because they directly relate to us. There is no way that we can directly relate to Buddha. There is no way that we can directly listen to the Buddha's teachings, hear his voice, and look at his face, and feel the inner peace and tranquility and the calmness and all those things. But with the Vajra master, we can do that. That makes the Vajra master much more valuable and precious to us compared to the Buddha. This is the first commitment or pledge. And the second those who wish to attain the inexhaustible state of Buddha's wisdom body should give to their guru whatever they themselves find pleasing, from the most trifling objects to those of the best quality. So this is the second commitment here. This is it. Whatever they like to have, whatever the disciples like to have in their life, all those things, they should offer it to their master. Will it be something extremely valuable and extremely precious or pricey? Or will it be something that is not too pricey, but at least the disciple likes it? Whatever they prefer to have, they should offer it to them. Then the third paragraph says, giving to your guru is the same as making continual offering to all the Buddhas. From such giving, much merit is gathered. From such collections comes the supreme powerful attainment of the Buddhahood. Making an offering to one's master is equal to making an offering to all the Buddhas. Because According to the Tantric text, all the Buddhas dwell in the one's master. As I told you on the first day, when I explained the first paragraph of the foundation of good qualities, according to the Tantric teachings, without having an initiation and blessing received from the alive, living master, there is no way that one can receive any initiation, unless if someone goes through very kind of special achievement or very special conditions. That is very rare. So for a general practitioner, the only source to receive any initiation and the blessings is the master. That is the nearest point to oneself from where one can get those blessings and those initiations and everything. So if the master doesn't exist, how can we get closer to the Buddhas? There is no way out. Just imagine, great master Tsongkhapa was enjoying direct interaction with the Manjushri. Manjushri is a deity. And he was enjoying a direct interaction with the Manjushri. He used to talk to Manjushri like we talk to another person. But still, he received great many teachings from his masters, live masters. Tantric teachings and the Sutra teachings, a lot. He studied with the a great many of those masters. And the Manjushri's, one of the main instructions was to him, always accept and look into your masters as same and inseparable to the deity. Don't look at your master as something ordinary, something common, equal to you, talking to you with all the problems in him, and then deity is something perfect, something great. If you keep on doing that, you will never get the real blessing from the deity, and never get the real blessing from the master too. That was Manjushri's direct instruction to Lama Tsongkhapa. So if it applies in that way to Lama Tsongkhapa, of course, it must have to apply in the similar way, exactly similar way to us. So, when Lama Tsongkhapa teaches the guru devotion in the Lamrim, he doesn't invent it. He was practicing those things for himself. And he wanted it to be practiced by his disciples who wanted to excel in their practices. So it is very important that people should avoid any kind of misconception and misunderstanding on the guru devotion part. I heard in many times that many teachers, they avoid teaching about the guru devotion because they feel it may send out a wrong message, a message that the master teaching, who is teaching the guru devotion, is sending out a message that you have to respect me because I am the master. It is not like that. Just take it like that. If I'm a Buddhist practitioner, I do also have a master. So I need to do the same things to the master. It also applies equally to me, not just to you. It also applies equally to everyone. So, if we keep on skipping this important part, then probably we are skipping the realization. Because this is the root of the realization. This is the first foundation of the realization. If we don't have that, how can we have the all those realizations? So from that angle, this is really very, very important. If you are willing to train yourself in that or not, that's an individual matter. But these are the factors. These are the facts that you need to understand. So it's like that. Then the second portion, out of the eight, the second portion is to accept and look into the Master as a real Buddha. And this is further divided into two, the actual instruction and how to avoid disrespectful, how to avoid being disrespectful, even avoiding to step on those shadow of the Master's body. So here, this is explained in the stanza number 22, which says that, therefore, a disciple with the good qualities of compassion, generosity, moral self-control, and patience should never regard as different his guru and the Buddha Vajradhara. So, a disciple with all these kind of qualities, compassion, generosity, moral self-control, and the patience, should never ever regard or accept that his master and the deity, or the Buddhas, and Buddha Vajradhara in this sense is a deity, is separate. They need to accept and have an understanding. Though it appears differently, of course, Buddha Vajradhara has a visual presentation, very specific visual presentation. Blue in complexion, color, and single face and two hand, and specific hand postures, and then ritual implements and all those things. But normally, Master doesn't appear in that way. Master is like a common human being, appear in the form of flesh and bones in front of us. So, this appearance is a very powerful thing that happens in our life. And driven by this appearance, we always take things separate from each other, because it appears separate to us, it appears distinct from one to another, so we take it separate from each other. But if something appears separate, it is not necessary that it has to be separate. If something appears same, and it is also not necessary that it have to be same. Because our appearance itself, whatever appears to us, could be wrong in many occasions. Our senses could be wrong. But the power of our senses and the attitude that we generally have to trust everything that appears to us is something very misleading, and we need to be very careful about that. In many occasions, the appearance of the things could be dependent on the environment and various conditions. So it's like that. So for that reason, it's very important that we don't run and just accept blindly what appears to us. We need to think beyond the appearance. We need to go beyond the appearance. That is very important. A lot of stories can be narrated here, but since we have a lot of things to explain for, so we can't do that. The next passage, or the stanza, number 23, says, explains, in order to avoid disrespect to one's master, try even not to step on his shadow of his body. So just think about it, how seriously the master is putting forward the idea. If you should never tread on even your guru's shadow, because the fearsome consequences are the same as destroying a stupa, is there a need to mention never stepping on or over his shoes or feet, sitting his place or riding his mount? So, in the text, of course, if we happen to destroy a stupa, it is explained in the text that it's a grave act of kind of non-virtue, and grave negative act or action. If it is like that, in the certain specific tantras, it is explained that even stepping over the shadow of one's master's body is much more grave and dangerous than destroying destroying a stupa. Just imagine in that way. What level and what kind of kind of importance is given to the master in the tantric practices. So if it is like that, then it is simply unimaginable to sit on the master's feet and stepping on the master's shoes and riding the master's mount. So nowadays, mounting a horse is kind of very rare. So maybe sitting on the master's seat in the master's car, something like that, you know, maybe applicable in that way. Unless if someone is permitted to do it by master, unless master says you sit there, you know, if it is permitted in that way, of course, that can be done. So it's like that. Okay. Now by this, we have covered the second one. The how to see the master equal and same as the Buddha. And the second, third one out of the eight is to be obedient, to obey and do according to, act according to the master's advices or the guidance. That one is explained in stanza number 24, which reads, A disciple having great sense should obey the words of his guru joyfully and with enthusiasm. If you lack the knowledge or ability to do what he says, explain in polite words why you cannot comply. This is the stanza number 24. So, whatever one's master says, whatever one's master instructs or order to do, a disciple should do those things willingly, with joyfully, with a sense of enthusiasm. And if there is something that the master asks the disciple to do, and disciple anyhow is not capable to do, physically, vocally, and mentally, to do that, and if it is out of the disciple's approach or disciple's capability, then the disciple should explain it to the master respectfully, in a, with a very polite manner. So here, if something is out of the capability of the disciples to do, the text and the instructions won't force the disciple to do those things. So Dharma, instructions, whatever is available in the Dharma, must have to be practical, practically applicable in the life. If something is there, it is not practical, not applicable practically in the life, then that is kind of, how to say, illogical and how to say that is, it's difficult to keep remembering certain words. So you can say it's simply illogical, you know. Like that. So Dharma is always applicable and logical and uncontradicting. So it's very important to understand that. Sometimes people unnecessarily exaggerate the things, and they say that that is kind of impractical, that is unimaginable, that is cannot be applied in that way. But it is not like that. Everything that is taught in the scriptures are applicable, but it depends on the time, period, and circumstances and conditions and a lot of things. It doesn't say that everything is applicable at one time. No, it won't be like that. But it is still applicable. And the second paragraph, which also deals with the same, which also covers the same topic, 25. It is from your guru that powerful attainments, higher rebirth, and happiness come. Therefore, make a wholehearted effort not to transgress your guru's advice. So, whatever attainments and realizations and the happiness that exists, that happens, that comes into your life, definitely comes from your guru. So, it is very important that one should obey those advices and do according to the instructions and advices given by one's guru, never stray away from the advices and the guidance that is given by one's guru. That is very important. Now here you may feel like that. I'm rich. I'm famous. And my guru don't have any role to play in that. According to Buddhism, even if you are rich, even if you are famous, even if you are kind of attractive, everything, whatever you achieve, have to come from its cause and its conditions. And its causes and conditions, definitely, you need to have it created. You need to have it accumulated. If you never have created those causes and conditions, you will definitely never enjoy those benefits. So, if it is like that, how did you create it? How did you create those things? When did you accumulate those things? When did you collect those things? Of course, according to Buddhism, in your previous lifetime. So, if you have done it in your previous lifetime, how? You did it by yourself, without any assistance of any other people? Is it possible? As I told you from the day one, just imagine. If you are born in a barbarian society to barbarian parents, then you will be taught barbarian values. Then you will grow up with those values. If you grow up with those values, of course, you will live with those values and you will cherish those values. If you live with those values, you cherish those values, you will definitely do according to those values. Now, in order to get these good deeds and the good karmas which may result into attractive physical appearance, possession of wealth, fame, and status, and all those things, definitely you may need to have plenty of good karmas in your stock, unless you won't get there. So, where does those good karmas come from? Definitely, in your previous lifetime, you have someone guiding you, teaching you, giving you those values. If someone has given you those values, yeah, that is your spiritual guide. So, whatever you own this lifetime, whatever good things that you have, it's a result of your spiritual guide. And whatever is going to happen in your next lifetime, it is also going to be a result of having a good spiritual guide. So, for that reason, it is very important that you should maintain a good relationship with your spiritual guide and never stray away from his guidance and advices. Now the number fourth out of the eight portions is how to deal with those belongings of the master and his retinues or the people surrounding him or his near relative like families and kids. If it's a lay person, kids and wife and so on, or maybe if it's a female master, his husband and his so on, like that, her husband and her kids and so on. It's explained in the paragraph number 26, which says, guard your guru's belongings as you would your own life. Treat even your guru's beloved family with the same respect you show for him have affectionate regard for those closely around him as if they were your own dearest kin. Single-mindedly think in this way at all times. So, whatever belongings, their wealth or such property and such thing of the master, a disciple should care for those things in a similar way. They care for their own wealth and something like that. And beside the master, as it is explained in the various many stanzas, that it's very important to pay the respect to the master. Now here it says, beside the master, you also need to pay the respect to the master's family, like wife and husband and so on, and the kids and retinues. The, you know, people who care for master and who live around master, and the relatives and so on. It's very important to maintain a friendship and a respectful approach towards all of them throughout the time. And the next, the number fifth out of the eight portions is how to maintain a pure conduct throughout the time is further divided into three portions. First is to avoid or to stop improper conduct, wrong conduct, and second one is to do the right conduct and to train oneself into the right conduct, and third one is how to stop the various improper conducts. So the first portion is explained explained in four stanzas, stanza number 27 up to stanza number 30, first half of the stanza number 30. And it is further divided into two portions, which says how to do in the presence of the master, where master can see us clearly. How to do, and the second one is how to do in the presence of the master, where master cannot see but hear. So there is a two different thing. In the kind of distance of where master can see us, it is a closer distance, and in the distance where master can hear us, it could be a longer distance, or maybe it could be due to different conditions, like someone could be blocked, there could be a blockage of wall or something, but master can hear the disciple's conduct and physical and vocal conduct, but cannot see. That could be one way. And master can see in their presence directly without that those disturbances or blockage. So these are two portions here. So first one is how to do in the presence of the master, where master can see the disciple. That one is the stanza number 27, which reads, never sit on the same bed or seat as your guru, nor walk ahead of him. At the teachings, do not wear your hair in a top knot, a hat, shoes, or any weapons. Never touch a seat before he sits down, or if he happens to sit on the ground. Do not place your hands proudly on your hips or wring them before him. So these are the certain conduct that one should avoid in the presence of the master. But many of these conduct is related to the customs. Those are specific to a certain society. Since bodhisattvas always respect the customs and the social values, those are prevalent in a specific society, in a specific kind of part of the world, in a specific community. So it may be, I don't say it is exactly, it may be interchangeable with few values that may be more prevalent in certain society. But basically, these things are kind of counted based on that society where the master, the author of this text was living. In that sense, one should not sit on the same bed or same seat equal to the master or same to the master, or one should avoid walking ahead of him. But some of these may have some exception. It will appear in the later part of the text. Do not wear your hair in a top knot. Now, in certain society, it is considered a display of kind of status or something like that, you know. If it is not a displaying of status in certain community, in certain society, then it may not be necessary to avoid such things. And then wearing a hat, shoes, or any weapons. Now, wearing a hat also is a displaying of status in certain society. Now, if it is physically necessary in certain part of the world, then it could be different, you know. So it's applicable in that way. Shoes or any weapons. Now, once again, it applies in the same way. Weapons, of course, is not necessary. It's like that. And touch a seat before he sits down. That means before the master sits down, one should not sit. And if the master is sitting on the ground, then one should not sit on the seat, like cushion or something like that. Place your hands proudly on your hips or wring them. Now this is once again an expression of status and something like that in certain society. If it is not like that in a specific community and society, then it may be acceptable. So it's like that. It's all kind of conditional, something like that. Then the paragraph number 28 also goes with the same kind of extension of same meaning. Same kind of matter is explained. It says, never sit or recline while your guru is standing, of course. Always be ready to stand up and serve him skillfully in an excellent manner. And then stanza number 29, where it says that in the presence of your guru, never do such things as spit, cough or sneeze without covering your head. Without covering your head. Chilmala from Dorba, the ten la combaton. Chapter, super mouth, let me do it myself. Without covering your head is not there in the Tibetan text, but I don't know from where the translator get it. Maybe I think in the translator's tradition, maybe covering head is a great kind of expression of respect. I don't know that. In the Tibetan original text, it doesn't say that. So it says that never stretch your legs when at your seat, nor walk back and forth without reason before him, and never argue. Yeah, argue is something, it's a, you know, chakpa is walking back and forth, but normally this is a kind of, we say, a walk, like a stroll. You just walk somewhere without any specific purposes. So it must not be done in front of the master. If there is no a very specific reason. And arguing is always disrespectful in the presence of the master, so it's very important to avoid it. And stretch your legs, of course, stretching your legs is kind of disrespectful, so it is very important to avoid it. And spitting in front of the master is... Now in a country like the United States and many other countries, normally spitting is not acceptable. If you spit in the street, maybe you can get a fine, you know. So in such a case, of course, it becomes much more serious here. But in Asia, back there in Asia, spitting is a very common thing. But even though you are not supposed to spit in front of the master. So these are like that, you know. And then, stanza number 30 reads, never massage or rub your limbs. Do not sing, dance, or play musical instruments for other than religious purposes. Oh, up to this point is under this portion of, under this heading, how to do in front of, in the presence of the master, where master can see the disciples. So one should not massage one's body, one should not stretch one's body, one should not rub one's limbs. But these things may happen from a kind of unintentionally. It is very important to not to do with that, with an intention. If we do it with an intention to be disrespectful, that is furthermore kind of damaging. If we happen to do those things unintentionally, it's a transgression, it's a breaking of vows, it's a breaking of commitment, it's a disrespect, but still not that serious. So it's very important to understand in these differences. Do not sing and dance or play musical instruments. Now these things can be acceptable in certain ways, like if you do these things in order to make master happy, maybe that can be acceptable, but depends on the conditions and circumstances. Then the second half of this stanza number 30 explains the next portion of the next portion, that is how to do in the presence of master, where master cannot see the disciple but can hear the disciple's kind of conduct. It says, never chatter idly or speak in excess or too loudly within the range of guru's hearing. Gossiping, meaningless gossiping, or even if there is a meaning, just keep on repeating that without any specific reason, those kind of things. And it is very important to avoid those things. But in the so these most of these things are also compiled from specific tantric treaties, like Vajramala, which is one of the explanative kind of commentarial tantra. Vajramala. Some of these are compiled from that, and some of these are compiled from Dorjin Nyingbuge, the ornament of the essence of the Vajra, that is also in Tantra. So it's like that. Then the next thing is, okay, we have still time. It's stanza number 31st, okay. Stanza number 31st, how to do. What kind of conduct one should do in front of the, in the presence of the master, or what should, what kind of conduct one should do, this general, is explained in the 31st one. It says that when your guru enters the room, get up from your seat and bow your head slightly, sit in his presence respectfully, at night or at rivers or on dangerous paths, with your guru's permission, you may walk before him. Okay, this is the exception that I told earlier. Normally, you are not allowed to walk in front of the guru, but in certain occasion, yeah, you could be allowed, or you, it is important to do. It is necessary to do it. So it's like that. When your master appears, and what you need to do is, you need to get up as soon as you see the master, and get up from your seat and bow in front of him, and stand respectfully in his presence, or sit respectfully in his presence. And in the night, and in certain occasion where there is a danger of water or river or something like that, or in various other dangers, then you should inform the master about possible dangers in front. So after informing the master, you can walk in front of the master in order to protect the master from such dangers. So this is an exception of the previous explanation. So let's just stop it here for today. It's the stanza number 31st. So stanza number 31st is explained. Now, if you have any question, you're most welcome. We have some time. And after that, we are going to recite the quick return prayer and the long life prayer. So if you have questions, please.
Gishi Rinpoche, your presence. I was just wondering, I got initiated last week, and I'm not sure if this is the right time to ask it or not. I don't really know, because I don't know that much about Buddhism. But I was just wondering what I heard that I needed to come back today to get my name or something.
Okay. Yeah, then first we should do that. Okay, thank you very much for reminding that. A few of you have taken the refuge precepts with me a few days ago on the 8th of March, and as I told you that day, the certificate is not necessary as long as you have the refuge cultivated within yourself. You are a Buddhist. But it's a modern tradition and American kind of culture to provide a certificate. So I'm providing this to you. So those disciples who requested for a name, please, you can come forward. I know that there are a few males and there are a few females. Let's just say female first. This is American tradition. Yeah. So we do a random selection. There are names. Maybe it's a... Okay. So I don't know what name you are getting, okay? It's up to you. Let's have this for you. Okay, this is your name over there. You can write your name over here in the blank place, and the given name is this, okay? Okay. Okay, here you go. This is your name, and you can write your name here, and everything is here, okay? Okay, your husband is... because male and female names are different, so if there is a mixed up, then it will become quite strange. Yeah, this is for your husband, so don't mix up these two. Okay. Oh yeah. Can I say another? Schmidroger. Okay. Yeah. Can I mean Dr. Chungsha?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So this is your name. You can write your name over here. And this is the given name, okay? Okay, here are the males. Okay. Here, this one is for you. And you can write your name over here, the blank space. And this is the given name.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, there you go.
Thank you very much.
You should write your name over here, and this is the given name, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, is that all? Okay. Now you carry on with your questions, please.
When you cultivate a guru, it's ideal, I would think, to have your guru geographically close to you. But would it be okay to have a guru who is not geographically close to you? And how often... would you suggest to have a kind of exchanges with your guru, if that's the case?
If you are close to your guru and you spend more time with your guru, that it is surely more beneficial to you because you can seek the Guru's advice and Guru's guidance every time, whenever you feel it is necessary. And Guru can advise you and guide you through your practices, through observing you, and in that way. But then at the same time, when your Guru is very close to you, there are more chances that you transgress the things. Because it's a very common, it is a very common problem, common human attitude. The more we spend time with a certain person, we tend to find more problems and more shortages and more kind of discrepancies and character problem in that person. That is a very, very common human attitude. And it is very important to train oneself against those basic common human attitudes. But if you have a guru living far away from you, then it is very easy to maintain the relationship. You know, you don't need to kind of you don't need to be kind of affected by guru's decision and guru's kind of advices and those instructions. So you don't really, it doesn't really bother you if whatever guru is doing. So it may be much, much easier to maintain a relation, a good and sound relationship with such guru, but that may not help that much in order to spiritually grow up. So it is always more preferable to have a guru much closer to yourself in order to get the maximum benefit from your guru, but then it has its own kind of, how to say, difficulties, but that you need to train yourself into so that you can manage to build up a good relationship, and it will be more helpful to you. Okay. Please.
Yes, yeah. How do we understand guru devotion in the context of the Sanghakaya, or building a harmonious Sangha?
Normally, guru devotion is something more in between disciple and the master. Now, the harmony between the Sangha community is in between the disciples and the members of the that community. It's a little bit different, but it can be connected. It can be connected in some way. Like if all of you are disciple of same master, then according to the, if you are initiated by same master, then according to the tantric teachings, you are Vajra siblings. If you are Vajra siblings, then you are like you are more or less like brothers and sisters, but in a very, very spiritual manner and very, very different way. And for if you are like that, it is very important to maintain some kind of pledges and commitments related to that. You should avoid insulting. You should avoid disparaging your Vajra siblings. So it works in a different way, but anyhow, there could be a certain connection. If you have more questions, you are most welcome. If you don't have, that means you understand everything, then that's good. If you understand everything, that's very good. Then if you, then the next important thing is to apply those in your life. Yeah, please carry on. There.
Hello. Is the only way to attain Buddha's or Buddhahood through the teachings, or are there other ways?
According to the Buddhist teachings, according to the Nalanda tradition that is well established in Tibetan society, there is only way through the teachings and through the practices and such things. There is no miraculous way that you can be an ordinary human being today and next morning when you wake up, you will be Buddha. There is no such kind of miraculous way. It could be really wonderful to have such a miraculous way. I would also like to have it, but unfortunately that doesn't exist. Okay, then shall we move forward with the recitations? Okay, please carry on.
Kanchenpoche, according to the text, a Vajra master is not necessarily an ordained person.
Ordained?
Because talking about family, okay. Wife and kids.
Not ordained in a individual liberation vows could be possible. But Vajra master definitely needed to be a person who have taken the vows. Vajra master, if as long as someone is a Vajra master, they definitely need to take the Bodhisattva vows. If someone never have taken the Bodhisattva vows, according to the kind of guidelines, that person cannot be given initiation. If the person cannot if a person never have received any initiation, how could that person be a Vajra master? There's no way. But it is possible, highly possible, that a Vajra master is not ordained in individual liberation vows, the kind of pratimoksha vows. That is, not a monk, not a bhikshu, and not a shramaneer. It is possible, but not possible that a Vajra master without any kind of vows taken in life, no possible in that way. Okay? Yeah, okay. Carry on.
Who might be our guru will only be around for like 2 years or something, and then they're gone. So it's hard to think that down the line they're going to help you and teach you tantra or whatever, because there might be the other side of the world. And the other thing is, our root guru is Dalai Lama. Well, how does that all fit in?
Now, who do you accept as a root guru? It's your prerogative. There is no intervention of anyone else. Whom you are going to accept as your root guru. It's up to you. And now, if someone is your guru and they can be with you for 2 years and then after that is gone, and that is an individual matter. Text doesn't say anything about that. And it's very difficult to solve it in a community, in a manner of kind of a society, you know. So since the practice is individual matter, it's very important to find out a way how to fill up that gap for yourself. But, you know, in general, there is one thing I think everyone should know. Even within the communities of the practitioners and the scholars and highly achieved, realized persons, there are different approaches towards the practice. There are certain well-established, highly realized masters who try to maintain the number of gurus much limited, so that they don't happen to transgress those relationship, sever the relationship. That is one approach. There is another approach of another group of highly realized masters. They, once they are well trained in the guru devotion, they keep on adding up the numbers of gurus. So just imagine the Atisha used to have 150 plus gurus in his life. So it's all dependent on individual. It's the individual's prerogative. Which path is most suitable for them? Okay, so let's move on with the recitations.
Okay, so the quick return prayer.
Yeah.
Geshe first, and then the long life prayer.
Yeah.
For Zenon Sakyo.
Yeah, let's start.
Oh, infinite Buddha.
Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you are the embodiment of uncontaminated and immutable great breeze. Kindly pour on us now your blessings, rains of nectar from the great clouds of your presence, pure and bright wisdom and compassion to eliminate your distress. We pray to the great hero who has perfectly realized within his mind the threefold ethics, Tathagata's teachings. He who has raised a powerful of Dharma in hundreds of directions. Your body is a son of all wonderful qualities, but all of a sudden it's set into solitary peace. You have committed before infinite Buddhas to work for Dharma and sentient beings. You could not have given up your commitment. However, your presence depends on the fortunes of disciples, for the power of dependent arising is inconceivable. Please reincarnate soon as a new light of Dharma. Out of your compassion that never abandons us, please return soon as the supreme spiritual guide, a treasure house of the immense teachings of the Buddha, a voice that eloquently elucidates the teaching that suits individuals' dispositions and capacities. Please return soon as a great king who will be known in all directions for smashing into pieces a mountain of misguided teachings and views through the power of your thunderbolt lightning of the three reasonings. An expert in the five sciences of Buddhism, whose eloquent words and calculation of teaching captivate the hearts of all the scholars and activate deep appreciation in pure enthusiastic minds. Please return soon as a spiritual guide, endowed with complete knowledge, kindness, and dedication. In regards to the perfect view, meditation, and conduct, one who facilitates the opening of the blossom lotus, that is the golden teaching of the Tsongkhapa, by the power of the three infallible jewels, by the power of dependent arising of unchanging emptiness, by the truth of our pure thoughts and devotion, may all our aspirations be spontaneously fulfilled. The more appearance of the myriad designs of your personal beauty on the surface of the mind's mirror makes one's immortality adamantine. O God of long life, vessel blessings, we pray to kind eminent Guru, who has abandoned all false and perfected visions in the way of great enlightenment, who has tamed himself with the nectar for the three types of mortality, and who is unmatched in explaining the vast scriptures. O Lord, noble protector of the world, for the liberation of the afflicted beings of his degenerate era, sit permanently and firmly on the indestructible throne, supported by eight lions for an ocean of eons. O moon of eloquence, the radiance of the white light, of your excellent knowledge and virtue, serves the vast milky ocean, the doctrine of Jetsongkhapa, glittering with the splendor of the jewels of liberation. May you live long. You are the unprecedented second lord of the gods, arrayed with the thousand eyes that distinguish the reality of the way of Dharma, beautified with the jewels ornament of love for sentient beings, possessing the hundred-pronged vajra of the bones of mighty Dharyana. May you live long. O supreme God, King of Kings, endowed with the fortitude to explain hundreds of texts, with fangs and claws that destroys the host of misleading guides, rich in the wealth of eloquent speech and exclusion, may you live long. O Lord, who has banished conceptual thought that claims to ordinary appearance, who has mastery over the supreme realizations of the stages of Tantra, in which whatever appears manifests as purity, may you live long as Vajra holder. May the kind spiritual teachers, skilled in teaching us, be king, without mistake, just as it is. May they live long, may their wishes be continuously fulfilled. May they be pleased to nurture us continuously throughout our future lives. By the blessings of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, by the power of unerring causal dependent origination, by the truth of our pure aspiration, may the good result of prayer be continuously fulfilled. Vietnamese? You can read. You can read whatever you like.
Thank you.